Your conference is being recorded.
Hi, Amy, are you there?
I am.
Okay, great. We'll start in just a couple minutes. I started the recording early because sometimes it sounds like I disconnect people. I don't want people to get the impression that they got disconnected.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Welcome, everyone that's joined us thus far. I hope you all had a nice Christmas and New Year's. And we're ready to get back at it, New Year. Did someone say something?
Becky said it's too cold.
Yeah, you're right. Some of you I know got hit by the flu. Our family did too, the stomach flu. So I hope that's all gone now. Well, it is 8 o'clock, so I want to thank you all for joining us tonight. We had quite a large number of folks that had registered for tonight. It was like close to 50 by the time it was. I sent out the materials. Did everybody get the materials I sent out this morning?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Great. So tonight we have with us Amy Bergen from Rehab Solutions Incorporated in Minot, and I'm sure she's going to tell us a little bit about that. Our discussion tonight is Social Security and how youth fit into that and what to look for. So, Amy, thank you for joining us tonight, and you know, let folks know if you want this to be real informal or how you would like to proceed. So, without further ado, thanks, Amy, for doing this tonight.
Yeah, sure. First, I want to say thanks to all the people that joined us this evening, took time out of their schedule to get on the phone call. I would prefer if you guys. Like, if you had questions, throw them out there. I find that having a more casual and conversational atmosphere is better for everyone involved. It makes things a little bit easier because Social Security can be complicated or it can be boring. So the more questions, the more conversation that we have, I feel the better it is. So please throw out the questions as we're going through. First, The materials that you should have gotten would have been the PowerPoint, and then also is a PDF that has a chart, and it explains just some of the different benefit types that a transition age youth may be receiving. And on the back side of that then is just some conversation topics for you to have with the youth that you're working with or that are part of your family or whatever the case may be, just some things to address, some things that kind of might be missed as they're in that transition process. So I'll kind of touch on that sheet a little bit later as we're going through. So if we'll just head over to the slides right now, I just have kind of just some top questions and answers that I hear most frequently from youth that are receiving benefits or the people that are supporting them. So I put together just those top ones. But by all means, if you have a question, please throw it out there. I don't want you guys leaving with any questions at the end of this phone call here. As Denise said, I am from Rehab Services, and I am a benefits planner. And my position is grant funded through the Social Security Administration, but I am not Social Security. So, I know all the ins and outs. That's part of my job. So I am here to share my information with you guys. So I guess we'll just kind of jump right into the first question. And what is the difference between SSI and SSDI and a child's benefit? When you go on to that second page, it the reason why I put that chart in there is because sometimes people aren't for sure on what their child or the person they're supporting, what that person would be receiving. And so if you guys just go over to that chart real quick, some major differences are highlighted in each of those sections that would be able to tell you what the transitioning youth would be receiving. SSI and SSDI are disability benefits, whereas that child's benefit is not a disability benefit. And that's one thing that I found has been kind of missed, because if a person is receiving a child's benefit, that benefit will continue until they're 18, or if they're still in school, it'll continue until they're 19. And then once they finish school, then that benefit stops. And families who have a child that is disabled oftentimes aren't aware that they can go on and apply for further benefits. Further meaning not only SSI, but also a childhood disability benefit, which that's that last group. And this childhood disability benefit is a disability benefit, and it's very similar to SSDI benefits, which is Social Security Disability Insurance. The thing with this childhood disability benefit is that youth, when they turn 18, if their disability began before the age of 22, they can collect or draw off of a mom or dad who is either disabled, retired, or deceased off of their work record. And so that went then is an option for them. And the reason I go back to that, the reason why it's important to know the differences in, you know, between an SSI or an SSDI or a child's benefit is one of those is that, knowing that not, you know, if that child benefit stops when they turn 18 or 19, that there is that potential to apply for SSI, but not only SSI, also childhood disability if they meet those requirements. Further down, the next highlighted area is, oh, and then my computer just turned off, but I can kind of go, sorry. the next area that's real critical or different between all of the benefits is that the health insurance. For somebody who is receiving a child's benefit, there is no health insurance. They don't get Medicaid. They don't get Medicare. For somebody who is on SSI, they are eligible for Medicaid, and they're categorically eligible, meaning they have to go in and apply. And once they apply, they should be good to go. The thing to remember with that is, this is common when I am working with somebody who is on SSI, regardless if they're, you know, 14 to 26 or, you know, 26 to 65. If they've moved into the area, they oftentimes feel like moved into North Dakota from out of state. They oftentimes think that, you know, that Medicaid should be following them and they should be eligible right away. And sometimes they forget or don't know that they have to go in and apply at the county social service office. And so some people, like, they could come from another state where it's just automatic, that state Medicaid program says it's just automatic. Once you're receiving SSI, you'll be eligible for Medicaid in our state. In North Dakota, we say, yep, you know, most likely you're going to be eligible. You just have to make that application. So that's another big difference for SSI. For somebody who is receiving childhood disability benefits, that Social Security disability type benefit, after 2 years that they are receiving that CDB benefit, that childhood disability benefit, 2 years, then they'll be eligible for Medicare. Medicare is not the same as Medicaid, obviously. Medicaid is state-run, administered health insurance, whereas Medicare is federal, and it is not state-run there. So if we go back to our PowerPoint, that kind of explains that chart, and if you have questions on how to figure out there's other differences between the benefits that you can look at and use to kind of narrow it down. The rest of this PowerPoint is really SSI heavy, supplemental security income heavy. And the reason why that is because most often somebody who is, you know, between the ages of 14 and 26, they're going to be eligible for SSI. Because to be eligible for SSDI, they have to earn, they have to have a work history. They have to have earned enough credits. So we're going SSDI. I'm going to explain just a little bit right now. SSDI stands for Social Security Disability Insurance. And to be eligible for that, you have to have worked. And every time we are working and we get our paychecks and we're looking and we're like, oh, they took out all this money for taxes. We're paying into the Social Security Trust Fund and we're earning quarters of coverage. And however many quarters of coverage then would determine how much our SSDI check would be if we applied for Social Security Disability Insurance. So when you're looking at somebody who is 16 years old and just started working, they haven't probably, most likely, earned enough quarters of coverage. So most often when they turn 18, and if they are receiving this SSDI type benefit, they're going to be under a mom or dad's record. However, I have seen some kids who they turn 18 and they've been out there rocking it, working and making lots of money, and they've earned eligibility right off the bat, like right when the moment that they're eligible, because it takes fewer for somebody younger to work. So I go back now to a lot of the information that I'm going to be touching on is going to be more SSI based. But if you guys have questions or you want me to talk about SSDI, let me know and I'll gladly share some more information. The next question is, where is it at here? Oh, what are some allowable resources that someone on SSI can have? So SSI is an income and needs-based program, and that means that the more income somebody has, whether it's unearned income, like they're getting maybe child support or a railroad retirement benefit or gifts of cash, or it's earned income, which would be wages from employment, the more income that they have, the lower their SSI check would be. So the max amount that somebody could receive from SSI would be $783 in 2020. And then, of course, they look at all of the other, you know, how much unearned income is coming in, and that can further reduce the amount. Resources now to be eligible for SSI, they can have up to $2,000 in cash. They can have a house. They can have one vehicle. They can have life insurance policies with a face value of $1,500 or less. They can have a burial plot or space, and then a burial fund of $1,500 each. They can have all the stuff in their house, and they can have all of their, you know, everything that they own in general would be an excludable asset. And then finally, the great one is ABLE accounts. These are really new. I hope you guys have all heard about them, but if you haven't, we'll touch on them a little bit later. But they're disability-related savings accounts where it allows a person with a disability to actually save money and build assets. So those are excludable from SSI. And most of those are very similar to what are excludable assets for Medicaid. Am I going too fast, or you guys have questions about anything? Okay, well, I'll keep on going. The next one is, can a youth who receives SSI work? And I don't know any scenario where it is not beneficial for somebody on SSI to work. And in fact, the person, if they're like under the age of 22 and going to school, that scenario becomes even that much more great because of a work incentive called the student earned income exclusion. But going back to the work is a good thing, they're earning credits to become eligible for SSDI if they need it later on. And how Social Security determines how much their SSI check is, remember how I said, you know, the more income, the lower the SSI check will be? Because they take, you know, certain deductions into consideration. For somebody who's a student, they don't do that. They exclude, if you go to that next slide, they exclude up to $1,900 per month of their earnings, and they do a total per year of $7,670 in 2020, so $7,670. And they just have to be working under 22 and regularly going to school. And so Social Security says for those youth that are in grades 7 through 12, that means that they have to be in school for at least 12 hours a week, in college at least 8 hours a week, and then a training course like Job Corps would be at least 12 hours a week. And so what that means is the student earned income exclusion, any income that comes in from that youth would not affect their SSI check, and so it would not go down. They would still get $783. So if they had $1,000 coming in, they would still get their income from $1,000, and they would still get their SSI check. It would not be reduced because that $1,000 would be excluded because of the student earned income exclusion, so they'd have that $783. So best case scenario for somebody on SSI is to work, especially while they're in school, because they're going to be money ahead. And even after they have, you know, hit that, let's say they're 23, you know, it's still beneficial for somebody on SSI to work, because even though that check is reduced, at the end of the month when they look at it, they're going to be money ahead because of working, rather than, you know, not working and having a $783 check. On the next page, the question is, will they lose their Medicaid if they work? And why is Medicaid so important? So they won't. They won't lose their Medicaid as long as they're following all of those other rules, and as long as the reason why their SSI check would go away is because they're rocking it, making lots of money, and it's reduced down according to their calculations, and the SSI check goes to zero. There's this different Medicaid eligibility group. It's called 1619B, and they would just move into that as long as they're following, like, $2,000 in their savings and checking accounts, not going over that, and they don't have like 10 houses and 5 cars. As long as they're following all of those other rules, they can have up to $47,554 before they would lose their benefits, their Medicaid. So a lot of times I'll get people calling and they'll be like, Amy, how much can I earn before I lose my benefits? And I'll just say, like, you know, $47,554, because truly that's the only time that it would affect a person's benefit, or you would see a loss of benefits for the negative. And Medicaid is important because it covers a lot of stuff. Not only does Medicaid cover health, but it also covers dental and it covers vision, but also it covers waivered services, and these waivered services would be like if they needed case management at a human service center, or if they needed to have supported employment through VR or through a community provider, or let's say they're getting ready to transition out into their own apartment and they might need some residential supports. That's what Medicaid waivered services would pay for. So keeping Medicaid is pretty important because that's the health insurance that's going to pay for things, but it's also can pay for just community supports too. The tip that I have in the corner is a lot of times people are concerned about losing Medicaid, but if you can think of Medicaid like a house, and in each room of our house, we have, you know, we have a living room and we have a kitchen and, you know, we have all these different rooms. And each, the house of Medicaid has different eligibility rooms too. So let's say our living room is our, you're receiving Medicaid because you're receiving SSI group. And then over into the dining room, that might be the, oh, you're working and you're making lots of money, and you're following all the other resources stuff. So, you're going to move into that group in the dining room, that 1619B group. And then there's other Medicaid groups, eligibility groups too, like there's a workers with disability Medicaid. The whole point of this is that you want to be able to move room to room to room. And as long as you can do that, you shouldn't be concerned about losing your Medicaid. But if you get, you know, evicted from the house, then you're going to have to find a new way to get back in the door of the house of Medicaid. So as long as you can find a different group, a different room to move into, Medicaid and keeping that shouldn't be an issue. Any questions on Medicaid stuff? Okay, you guys are really quiet. on the next slide, then, we'll go on to what is an ABLE account and why should a transition age youth want to open an account. ABLE accounts, touched on them a little bit ago. They're disability-related savings accounts, investment accounts, actually, because they have the ability, if you think of them, they're kind of like an IRA. You know how when you set up an IRA, you have a level of risk in your investment options? And so for an ABLE account, they have that same kind of level of risk. They have the savings all the way up to the stocks and bonds in as far as how aggressive you want to have the money in your ABLE account be. Just a short little version of this is somebody can have an ABLE account and they can have $100,000 in their ABLE account before it even remotely begins to affect eligibility to means-tested programs. And when I'm saying means-tested programs, I'm talking about SSI and I'm talking about Medicaid, housing, and SNAP. And ABLE accounts offer that ability to build assets because before ABLE accounts were signed into law in 2015, when someone was nearing that resource limit of 2,000, it was like, oh, okay, you know what? At the end of the month, I got to spend money. I got to get below. And so they're always spending money. And so when you think about it, how many people need 10 TVs or, you know, 5 TVs or 4 new couches or whatever the case may be, just so they can get below that resource limit? And so when ABLE accounts came to be, they're like, oh, this is a whole new option to actually save money. Because people that have disabilities, everybody's disability is unique. And, you know, they're not cheap. There's a lot of expense that people don't realize goes into or that is there for somebody with a disability. So this offers that ability to build assets, and that money in there can be used to pay for disability-related expenses. And the thing to remember, though, it's not all like straight up, oh, I can pay for my medical bills or, oh, I can pay for, you know, my doctor co-pays or whatever. If you can trace it back around to how it's related to a person's disability, then that money in there can be used. That money in an ABLE account is, they say that it's intended to increase or maintain quality of life. And so it can be used to pay for housing, like for their rent. I had a gal who opened an ABLE account, and she used the funds in there to pay for her her college tuition in her books. And so now you're thinking, well, how does that relate to disability? Well, she chose a college that had good handicap accessible buildings, or the dorm that she liked had a good handicap accessible layout. And the different books that she would require, like the tablet and whatever, that was also, she needed that to, for her to learn and go through the classes, the software and stuff. So it's all traced back to, you know, her disability. A person can place up to $15,000 in 2019 into an ABLE account before, if they're working though, they can place even more into that. $15,000 is that gift tax rate. And so as you see in 2020, when they come out with that gift tax rate, I'm guessing it'll bump up a bit, that will be the same max amount that somebody can place into an ABLE account per year. To have a disability before the age of 26 is the last requirement, not only the disability requirement, but the age requirement. There is some legislation pending that they are hoping to increase the age, and I haven't heard where that's at, but be watching for that, because if that is changed and it ups a little bit, it opens up to a whole bunch of more people. So ABLE accounts, the tip there, if you have somebody who hasn't graduated from high school yet, what's the normal gift that somebody gets for graduation? Somebody?
Money.
Yes, money! And that, I mean, for all intents and purposes, they're super excited to get money, and people are, you know, excited to give that money. But they don't realize that somebody on SSI, when they get gifts of cash coming in, it can affect their SSI. It's pretty much reduced dollar for dollar after they subtract out $20. So remember how I said that $783 is their SSI check? If somebody got a total of, you know, $900 because they graduated, they would have to report that as income coming in. And for that month, then they wouldn't get an SSI check because of all their graduation money. So an alternate plan would be to open up an ABLE account, because somebody can place funds into an ABLE account. A third party can place funds into an ABLE account for a person, and it won't affect eligibility for their SSI or their Medicaid, because it doesn't come into their hot little hands. It goes directly into an ABLE account. So if you have somebody who is looking to graduate soon, totally have them set up an ABLE account, or even like at Christmas time or Christmas gifts or birthday gifts. As long as that money does not come into their hands and it goes directly into the ABLE account, it's totally okay. Down below, there's a website link. It's ablenrc.org. Great resource to look at, to check out information on ABLE accounts if you're not quite sure about them. Also, North Dakota, we are not doing an ABLE account, but we can shop around any state that is offering out-of-state enrollment, and if we find a good fit with whatever account that you're interested in, then you can go ahead and open that up in another account. Any questions on ABLE accounts right now? I have a question, Amy. Go ahead.
Is there a time limit on the ABLE account? Do they have to use it by a certain date, or does that extend forever?
A time using the money in the ABLE account, are you talking?
Yes.
Yep, no, they can have it for however long, for their entire life if they want. It is subject to the Medicaid payback provision, just like the Medicaid stuff is if you're receiving Medicaid. So what that means is that when that beneficiary would pass away, all the funds in the ABLE account would pay first outstanding debts, and then it would go to the state after that. Did that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
Okay. Did someone else have a question?
Oh, I did. As far as opening up an ABLE account, being that North Dakota doesn't offer them, how does one go about doing that?
Yeah, so you hit up that website and kind of just check out all the different ABLE accounts that are out there. And then what I tell people is, you know, find your ABLE account, and then you, when you're on that website, you should be able to click directly to that state's website, and from that point there, then you do the enrollment process. But before you do it, if you have questions at all, call up that state ABLE account and ask the questions of them there.
Okay.
Setting up an ABLE account is really, really simple. I mean, if you've ever set up an online savings or checking account, it's the same
right.
thing.
Okay.
All that info is in there.
Thank you. Got it.
Yeah.
And Amy, I'll just add that there are some of our Family Voices staff that have been helping families set up ABLE accounts too for their children and their youth for that have a disability.
Oh. Yeah, great. That's great to know, because like I technically can't help set up, but I can give you all the information in the world. So I'll just be referring everyone to you guys then.
Well, I see. No, I should probably. I mean, we'll help guide them through the process. We can't help them set it up, actually.
Ah, yeah. Okay, I gotcha. Mm-hmm. Any other questions on ABLE accounts before we move on? Okay. If you guys think of something, like I said, throw it out and we'll hash it over. The next slide is, how likely is it that a student with disabilities will lose eligibility to SSI? So there's this thing in, I skipped the slide. I'm sorry. Let me back up here. Why? I'm backing up two slides here. Why do some youth lose SSI when they turn 18? Have you guys heard of the age 18 redetermination? Anyone?
Yes.
Okay. So the age 18 redetermination, it's basically Social Security's way of saying, okay, you're becoming an adult now. And now we have to redetermine your eligibility to SSI when you turn 18. And the reason why they do that is because people under the age of 17, like a child disability, is less stringent, the criteria to qualify for that. And so somebody say, not to downplay this, but somebody say with ADHD may have qualified as a child, but as they turn 18, they may not qualify as an adult because they might be the qualifying criteria is a little bit different. It's a little bit harder to qualify for those things. So what happens there is sometime in that year that they're turning 18, they have to do a review, and Social Security sends out paperwork to the family, and then they'll also send it to the teachers. And families think that, oh, this is just a normal annual review, and they really don't know what's going down, that it is this age 18 redetermination process. And it's important to know that because you want to put and gather as much information as you can to add into this review, and then also give a heads up to, you know, the teacher saying, you know, this is going to be coming. And they should be aware of this as well because this happens frequently with them. But if they have information about how their ability is to follow directions in school, or, you know, if they're on job sites, if they have examples of how they handle job sites, That's all great information that they should be adding into that. The other thing is just understanding the whole process of that age 18 redetermination. Like I said, it happens within that 18th year. And to be prepared that if something was, if there was a negative outcome following this redetermination process, to be prepared is important, because if there's a loss of SSI, if they say they're no longer eligible, they will get 2 more months of benefits, that cash benefit, as well as that Medicaid benefit. But then after that, they're done. Like, there's no more SSI or Medicaid. And so when I say, like, plan for it, just be proactive and say, okay, you know what, if this is the case, you know, what are we going to do? How are we going to make sure that, you know, all of their needs are met in this, for these items? A lot of times people go through this, though, and there isn't an issue with it. It's just, it's really dependent on what that person's disability is and how severe or impairing it is, or their ability to work. And the next one, how likely is it that a student with disabilities will lose eligibility to SSI? They did a study, and in 2016, approximately 52% of childhood SSI recipients were initially determined to be ineligible for SSI. And when people get that notice, they should not think that this is like the end-all be-all, like it's done, we're done dancing. Every notice that a person gets from Social Security, they offer the ability to appeal it. Always appeal. Always appeal. Because you can share more information that could benefit that determination or benefit that overpayment notice or whatever the case may be, the reason why they received this notice. So always appeal and provide more information. Don't think that it's just something that you have to accept. So I touched on it a little bit more or a little bit before when I talked about the ADHD. Certain behavioral or learning disabilities tend to be more likely not to meet the adult standard. The other thing to look for if people are concerned about that is if somebody who had to appeal their decision as a child, that initial SSI decision, or if they've, you know, experienced an improvement in their impairment since they had their approval, that would be something that would be kind of a red flag for you to be watching for and plan for, you know, making those contingency plans. The other thing to look for and do is get them hooked up with vocational rehabilitation as soon as you can, hopefully before they turn 18, and also make sure that they're under an IEP at school, because if they do get that adverse decision, they can appeal and request Section 301, and what that does is that it says they will continue to pay benefits and that Medicaid eligibility for the time that they're enrolled and receiving services either through VR or through their IEP. I can't always say that it's a for sure thing because a judge would have to look at that and say whether or not they'd be eligible for it, but it's definitely kind of a built-in protection there if they're doing that. The reason why they say that they would look at doing that is because involvement in either an IEP or school or with voc rehab is more likely to lead a person into achieving financial independence. And so Social Security is more apt to saying, yep, you know what, we'll keep you on if you meet those criteria. So enroll them and have those IEPs updated or keep them in place. The next one. Can anything be done?
I have a quick question.
Sure.
My daughter has a 504, not an IEP.
So would that
I would think that that should be, I can't say for sure. I know that IEPs specifically, I've not heard anything about the difference in between that and a 504. So I can look at those rules. And if you want to email me, I think my email is in the beginning of the slide. If you want to email me that, and I can give you a for sure answer when we're done. But right now, I would, I can't answer that without looking straight into it.
Okay. I don't think I see your email in the slide, though. I think we just have unless I'm blind.
At the very, it's that second slide, and it says Amy Bergen, and then it's ndbenefits@outlook.com.
Oh, well, I don't see you. I see Terry's email, but it's
ndbenefits@outlook.com.
Okay, thank you.
Yep, thank you. Let me see here. So I think we're on the, can anything be done to prepare for the age 18 redetermination process? We talked about, you know, sharing that information with the teacher, you know, like if they've got work experience coming up or anything like that to ask that they be sure to put that on there, how they did on the job site or, you know, redirections. And then, basically, what will happen is that you'll sign just a medical release, and then they'll be able to gather all of your medical records. But the important thing for you to do, or the child or the youth to do, is to go through and remember all of the different places that you've been seen. Because if, like, let's say that your primary disability would be diabetes, but like a secondary one would be glaucoma, and you should provide all the information that you have, not only for the primary, but also for that glaucoma. So you're going to be making sure that you give them your optometrist or your ophthalmologist information as well. Just anyone who has seen that person, or psychiatrist or psychologist, anyone who has seen that person, or any tests or anything like that that you've had done, or that, I'm sorry, that they've had done, be sure to note that on that review. And let's see. I talked about that before, developing a contingency plan. If there's any questions or concerns, you can always refer them or give me a call for benefits planning, and just we can discuss or go through those things. Any questions at that time? And let's see. Is there anything that can be done if the age 18 redetermination decision isn't favorable? I already kind of touched on that. I got ahead of the game here. Section 301, that's temporary continuation of benefits, if they're hooked up with VR or an IEP. And then, let's see. Always remember to appeal. Don't think that that decision is set in stone. The next slide is, what happens if they get a student loan or grant to pay for college? How will that affect their SSI? All student financial aid is excluded if it's under like the HEA or the BIA program. So it won't be counted for income or resources regardless of the use. So some examples over on the left-hand side, those would be Pell Grants, academic achievement, and academic achievement incentive scholarships, those federal loans, Stafford loans, Perkin loans, and then work-study programs also shouldn't affect their income or resources. And the resource exclusion for this education, this assistance,
doesn't have a time limit. And so regardless of how long that assistance is held, it's going to be excluded from resources. The only kind of caveat to that one is let's say that they get, you know, $1,500 to pay for their tuition and books, that if they don't use that money to pay for that and instead use it to pay for something else that is not related to school, then that money would be counted against them at that time. The next slide, how can someone who wasn't eligible for SSI as a child now be eligible as an adult? And the big thing is once they turn 18, Social Security says, you're an adult now. We aren't going to be checking out mom and dad's income or their resources anymore. So we're only going to be looking at yours. And a lot of times, somebody who was not eligible as a child then also becomes eligible as an adult because that mom and dad stuff isn't there anymore. So if you didn't or weren't eligible, be sure to apply. And the first month that you can make an application would be the month after they turn 18. So you can call up Social Security. Let's say your birthday is in May. You call up and set an appointment up for June to have that application taken, and then they should be able to go start with June, because still in that month that you turn 18, you're still 17, so they're still going to be looking at mom and dad's stuff at that time. And that is kind of it all on that PowerPoint. And I know, like I said, I talked pretty heavy on the SSI. So if you guys have questions about SSDI or anything like that, please shout them out.
Amy, one question that I have, does RSI have a service area, or do they cover the entire state if someone was wanting some assistance?
Yep, we cover the entire state. So it's actually me who covers Minot, Western North Dakota over to the Montana border, and then Canada to, oh, there goes my dogs, Canada to South Dakota, and then about to Devil's Lake area. And then the eastern part of the state, Mark Melhoff, he covers that part all the way the rest of the state. If you guys have questions about anything, you can, like who to call or whatever, you can just call the main office, which is the 701-839-4240, and they can refer you on to who you should be talking to.
Okay, that's awesome. I wasn't sure of your service area either, so I'm glad I asked.
Yeah, yep.
Does anybody have any questions for Amy at all? Don't be shy.
I have a question, Amy.
Oh.
I had a question. I guess I was sort of looking at, well, all of this was super informative, so thank you. I'm wondering, my daughter actually does not have SSI, but we've been told that we should apply. She is disabled. But I've always sort of just not done it because worried about the income. And it's just so, like, I honestly don't understand at all how that works when you have a child, like what they look at as far as parental income. Like, do you have an actual chart, or is there something that we could look at or someone we could talk to even know if that would be a possibility for our family, being that obviously my husband works and makes income?
Right. So that's the thing that I hear often. People are like, hey, I'm working or whatever, and we're not going to be eligible. I always tell them, just go ahead and apply. Like, what's the harm in applying?
Right.
The worst thing that they can say is no. And the best thing that they can say is, yep, and here's some Medicaid for you. Or here's a cash benefit for you.
Right.
Also, the other perk to it is that if you go through that whole thing, they they would come back, and if they say that you are not eligible because of your mom and dad's income, but you met the disability criteria, that's a flag right there that says, yep, I'm calling that month after they turn 18, and I'm going to be making an application.
Right.
The other thing,
okay.
Yeah. The other thing to think about is, Social Security doesn't count all of the parents' income. They take several deductions into consideration too. So don't think that you're out of the game here. Just apply.
Okay. Awesome. Thank you.
And if I can add just one thing to that, Amy, sometimes when families have asked us that question, if they do apply for SSI, one thing that I've always told families is that think about, because sometimes the care for our children becomes very routine to us, and we don't think twice about it. So I always tell families to think about if they were going to leave their child with me for 2 weeks to go on a vacation, what is everything that I would need to know, all the little intricacies that your kids may do, because oftentimes it does become so routine for us, and to write that down so that when you're filling out that application online or however at the Social Security office, you have that all in one place so that you, when those questions are asked about their daily activities and things like that, you have that all right there and you don't have to think twice about it.
That is
such a
great suggestion. Yes. Yes. So true.
So my daughter is disabled. She did get SSI for a little while, and then I got a raise, and we didn't get SSI anymore. She turned 18 in December, and I called in November. I called the Social Security office after about an hour wait online, but on hold.
Oh.
And got through, and I asked them what I was going to need to do once she turned 18, like if there was anything I needed to do to make sure she kept her Medicaid, that didn't get lost in just get shut down or whatever. But she also is on the DD waiver, so that didn't stop because hers goes through February, which will then reapply, and that's why she stays on that Medicaid. And they told me that as long as she's living at home and doesn't graduate until May, that she probably isn't going to qualify for SSI anyway. So just to wait, and we'll start that process, then she'll qualify once she graduates.
I don't know why they would have told you that. I would have said, okay, I'm going to – did you make an appointment anyway?
I didn't. They told me to wait until, like, March to make the appointment so that we could get the ball rolling so that by the time May came around or June 1st came around, because she graduates on May 31st, June 1st came around, it would be in effect and be ready to go.
The only thing that I could say to that might be, before they're 18 and they're 17, mom and dad's income affects how much their SSI check would be, right? When they turn 18, that SSI check would be dependent on if there's any in-kind support going on. And what that means is, like, if that 18-year-old is still living at home and they're not paying anything for their rent or their groceries or anything like that, their SSI check could be reduced. And depending on what income is coming in also, it just may prevent an SSI check going out to them too. So that might be why they had said that. But again,
I'm not going to charge her to make her pay her own groceries while she's living still at home going to high school. But I do get child support because her dad and I are divorced. And so
that might be the reason.
Might be the reason why they said that. Because, I mean, who charges their child rent and to pay for their groceries while they're still in high school?
I'm going to share a little, like, what do they call them? Like a pro tip?
So he does get it.
So the rent first off, if you charge them rent, because Social Security says, you know what, I'm going to give you this 783, and you're going to use this to pay for your living expenses, right? And if you don't, you're going to get a reduced amount. I think it's going to be like right around $500, if not more. I can't remember. I have so many numbers floating in my head. But
okay.
Right around $500. And if you just say, like, enter into like just a rental contract, and you say, I'm going to pay, you know, $200, and I'm simply renting a room in your house, then that should be enough to bump her up to the full amount. And then what you can do is you open up an ABLE account, and that $200 you're charging for rent, you can throw it into that ABLE account, and it's she can use it. She can pull it out the next month, that $200, to pay you. And you can keep throwing it back in there. So it's kind of like this little cycle of money going around. But because you're that third party depositing into the ABLE account, it won't affect her.
Okay.
It's like a cheat.
So that,
a hack.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's good. That I'm going to make it. I have a couple days off next week. I'm going to make an appointment or do the thing online for her.
Yeah. The only thing that may prevent would be that child support that's coming in, depending on how much it is.
Much, and it's the combination for two kids. So,
okay, be sure to let them know that that's the case. You know.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, because I was like, gosh, that seems so weird that they would have told me that if you know, now I should be telling them. You know, that she should be applying since she just turned in December, so. Okay.
And it could have been maybe a total miscommunication or a misunderstanding. I don't know. But.
Yeah, it could have too. I don't know. So, okay. And I don't have to get all of her medical records. I can just sign off on the releases, right, to every location?
Yep. Yep. Yep, yep.
Okay. Is that the preferred way to do it, or does it take longer?
Like I said, as long as you have information or know what places that she's been seen at, then be sure to put that down so that they, when you sign that release form, they can get in contact with those places.
Okay. Does it take longer for them to do it that way than trying to request them all yourself and take them with you?
You know what? If it was me, I would just do that because it might take a little bit longer, but oh man, think of the headache that you'd be going through unless you had all the access to your files right on hand. But I would just sign the release form.
I just hope that they always get the information then. That's where I'm always like, well, do they always get the information from all the places they send the requests to?
Well, that's the other thing when I said you can always appeal, because when you appeal, you can ask what's in the file or what information was gathered, and you know you could check in and you could be like, oh, okay, so I listed on here Trinity, but I don't see anything from Trinity, and then you know handle it that way.
I don't think it'll be a problem for unfortunately, fortunately, I guess, I don't know. Just because he hasn't gotten any better, it's only gotten worse. So,
oh, okay. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Well, that's just the reality of a muscle disease. So, you know. But
yeah.
Okay. Okay. Well, that's helpful and very useful information. Thank you.
You bet. Any other questions?
Hi, yes, I have a question. My name is Jordan. I'm a social worker for Ann Carlson Early Intervention. And our team, according to them, I'm the first social worker in about 15 years to be on staff. And I previously come from a NICU setting, so I'm decently familiar with SSI based on medical diagnosis and birth weight and such. But I was wondering, do you guys have any specific individual who would be open to, like, doing in-service for my team? Because they have questions that I don't really know the answers to, but I learned even more just tonight listening to the and looking at through the slides that you presented on, Amy.
Yeah. Like, what age group are you working with?
We work with birth to three.
Birth to three.
Yep.
I could just kind of briefly share information. Because the thing is I can't help make that application or help a person
right.
get on benefits. But
right.
I guess I think it was the SSI program.
Yeah, I think it would be more along the lines of like a Q&A versus how do we get them to apply for it. Because I know the application process solely from previously working with these kind of kiddos, but I know a lot of my coworkers have questions like, well, what if they have this or what if they have this or a lot of questions like that I don't really know the answer to. And I see that Mark is in the Fargo area.
Yep.
So would you maybe recommend that I just email him and see like if what his thoughts are or?
Yeah, you can check in with him and see.
Okay.
Or see if he knows if there's somebody else that's in his area that would be better equipped to answer those
okay.
questions. So,
okay.
Yeah.
I'll just reach out to him then. Thank you.
All right. You bet.
Jordan, one thing that might be helpful is Social Security has either it's a red book or a blue book. For the kids, I think it was a red book. And that kind of outlines all of the, neurological, it breaks it down into sections, and then you can see there what they look at for their criteria. And if I find that link, I'll send that to you, Jordan.
Okay, perfect.
And Ashley,
I'm sorry,
just going on the...
about the red book?
Deneen was, I think.
Yeah,
oh, yeah.
Was...
I think I found it online here.
And I think it would be the blue book.
The red book
is about work incentives.
Employment.
Okay.
Yep.
Yep.
The blue
yeah.
book would be the one to go to. Okay. I will look
yep.
at that and review it.
Not only that, but just going on the SSA.gov website, you can get a lot of information on just clicking through their disability benefits section.
I have done that. I feel like it's not very user friendly though. So, for me,
yeah,
anyway,
I get it.
I don't know.
I get it.
So
you need a decoder ring. You need a decoder ring to read the Social Security
yeah.
lingo.
Exactly. And if you don't know, like if you don't have any experience with it, it's going to go right over your head.
So, oh, yeah.
Okay. I'll run through the blue book, and Deneen, I'll call you if I have any questions.
Okay. No worries.
Perfect. Thank you.
Did anybody
Thank
else
you.
Have any questions for Amy before we end for the night? I want to make sure we didn't cut anybody off. Okay, hearing none. Amy, thank you so much. I think that was great. We'll put the slides up and the fact sheet that you send up on our website with the recording. So if you want to look back on it, you sure can. Or if you want to tell somebody else that it's there, that's fine too. So thanks again, Amy, for doing this tonight.
You bet. And, if anyone does have any questions, you can reach out to me, and we can kind of answer things at that time, too. So thanks. Thanks for inviting me, Deneen.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you. Night, everybody.
All right.
Bye.
Thank you. Thanks, you guys.
Cool.
Good night.
Thank you.